Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for all for coming, and thank you for having me here. My name is Russell Osco. I'm a soil scientist and a geologist. My co-author, Martin Helmke, couldn't be here today. Wanted to talk about things that we have noticed using drip irrigation as a method for on-site wastewater disposal in serpentine-derived soils. And this is kind of a retroactive pilot study here. We didn't go into this trying to test drip irrigation. We were using something that was already recently permittable in the state. Now we're going back and taking a look at these sites to see if they're worth spending more time on. So this is going to be heavy on anecdote and light on data at this point. But if you have never seen serpentine before, this is what it looks like when you build a church out of it. It's a green stone about the same color as my shirt. This is a general geologic map of the state of Pennsylvania, and I must say I'm a Pittsburgh native. I was born and raised here. And so when I saw this map for the first time in freshman year of high school, I thought, gee, isn't it great that I live in this nice blue area here where everything is nice and even and not in this big mess down here. Karma can be a terrible thing sometimes. I live right here now and have been working there for 23 years in soils. So let's zoom in on my new home here. Our bedrock is crystalline metamorphic rocks, very old, very deformed. But I want to draw your attention to these green areas here. These are serpentine barrens. Let's zoom in a little bit more. And I want to focus on one small serpentine barren in particular, this one right here. And we're focusing on this one just because of the coincidence that we happen to be working on that one, and we happen to use drip irrigation in a number of instances there. Now, if you're not familiar with serpentine, it is a very unusual bedrock. It's an ultramafic bedrock known as serpentine or serpentinite. It's seen here as inclusions of serpentinite within gneissic country rock, and its origins appears to be associated with island arc magmatism, probably in the late Ordovician. These are believed to be the remnants of volcanic islands that were accreted onto the edge of the craton back at about that time. And you notice I'm spending a lot of time on geology and not a lot of time on soil here. We'll start to get into the soil. When you're dealing with the serpentine-derived soils, of the five soil-forming factors, parent material seems to be the tail that wags the dog here. These are mapped as Chrome series soils, as inclusions within the Glen Elg series. And I give the classifications right off of the NRCS website here. Fine mixed superactive mesic typic haplodelphs with KSAT values that are moderately high to high for the Chrome series. The Glen Elg is very similar. Semi-active instead of superactive, and a haplodelt instead of a haplodelph with KSATs that are moderately high to high. So this begs the question, if you're a soil scientist working in the field, how would you tell this stuff apart? And we're missing something here, because once you get boots on the ground, this is actually, the background is the Chrome series soils. I won't bother trying to do a visual comparison of Chrome and Glen Elg, but when you get boots on the ground and the stuff sticks to your boots, you know you're in the Chrome series. Glen Elg doesn't do that usually. In actuality, the Chrome series is moderately deep to shallow. It is extremely variable. I have seen in the same backhoe pit depths to bedrock varying from 6 inches at one end of the pit, 6 feet in the middle, and 6 inches at the other end. The stuff is highly deformed. It is moderately well to somewhat poorly drained generally. Permeability is extremely low, and we attribute that to the presence of expansive clays. There does appear to be schmechtite clays that form in this. And I kept calling these serpentine barrens for a reason. It's because you can't grow very much on them. They have high levels of nickel, chromium, and cobalt, sometimes toxic levels of those. And so the plant communities are very specialized there. Indeed, the name of the soil series comes from the fact that they used to mine it for chromite. And asbestos is one of the byproducts of the formation of this soil series, so we have to be careful when we're working in this stuff. The Glen Elg series, on the other hand, is deep. It's moderately well-drained to excessively well-drained, and permeabilities are actually moderately high to high. We have measured permeabilities on this site of 0.015 centimeters per hour. This is really slow. And I must say, I have seen actually negative permeability values on this. If you are using an uncased borehole to do your test and the clays start to swell and close the borehole up and the water rises up, it can really be really disturbing the first time you see that. But this is an area of high demand for housing. This is very valuable real estate. You'll notice by the modest little bungalow in the background, that's about a $1.5 million house. One buildable acre of land in this area is worth $350,000 to $550,000. So there's significant pressure to develop on these properties. And that house belongs to an engineer who was a friend of mine. Now, looking at an aerial view, and I didn't even bother, and I thought I saw Ed White in here. I'm not really picking on NRCS people, Ed. But this area is mapped on the Webb Soil Survey as being all Glen Elg. They completely missed this inclusion of chrome because it is just too small. And we were able to define this very well. You'll notice that I cut off the corner of this lot in mapping the chrome, and that is because we have a gravity in-ground system there. It is definitely Glen Elg series. Inside this is definitely chrome series. We have a total of 5 new homes. This one here is the one that was in the previous slide while it's under construction. 5 new homes that had to be served by drip irrigation because they would not be suitable for any of the standard septic systems. As I said, we didn't go into this initially to do research. I had clients that owned this property, and they had me on standing orders that, Russ, if anything ever comes up that we can build on this, let us know. Well, in 2000, Pennsylvania approved drip irrigation for use as a method of on-site sewage disposal. They required secondary treatment, mechanical filtration to around 100 microns. It uses micro-dosing and broad dispersal and time dosing. And these gizmos on the right are the magic part of drip irrigation, the drip emit or the pressure compensating emitter. I won't spend a lot of time on that. We could talk about that afterwards. We went with a application rate far lower than what was required by the regulatory agencies of 0.13 gallons per day per square foot. And that is based on peak flows. So average flows are probably about half that. And this is what happens when you take a pressure compensating emitter and put it under pressure. You'll notice we're using unsaturated flow here. So essentially water movement vertically is roughly equivalent to what is horizontal. And since we are using a time dose, our doses are generally less than 5 minutes. So we're wetting a very small area at each emitter. We're taking the effluent, spreading it out over a very large area. And gravity doesn't start to act on this until we're well into a longer period of time, which we are not going to run into. So we have essentially, by using unsaturated flow, doubled or possibly quadrupled the amount of soil that is going to be absorbing the water in any given time. So in this one area, and we have many in other areas, but this one that we are looking at as our pilot study, we have 5 of these that have been used for 6 to 7 years. Including this one, this was a new construction, an experimental system on very shallow soils that were 10 to 15 inches deep. And just by luck, 2 of the homeowners are civil engineers who I communicate with on a regular basis, and they like their systems and they monitor them themselves. The others we drive by and check on from time to time, and we have had no breakouts on the surface with these systems. So the drip irrigation is worth looking at in these expansive clays. The pros and cons. The pros, it's allowed development of otherwise unbuildable land. It's environmentally sound, uses low impact to soils as opposed to, for example, a mound system. Should give system longevity. They're aesthetically desirable. If you're building a $1.5 million house, you don't want a giant mound in your front yard. These are trenched in right into the epipedon. And more important from my perspective, this is now applicable in repair replacement systems. These serpentine barrens for a long time were cheap land to buy. So the lower income people, that was the only place they could build a house. And now their septic systems are failing. And this is probably the only technology that they can use to repair those. The cons, you'll notice my first con is the same as my first pro. It allows development of otherwise unbuildable land. Maybe we shouldn't be building everywhere. As I said, these are very unique ecosystems, very unique plant communities. Expense is one of our biggest cons. For a single family home, we're talking about a septic system that costs on the order of $25,000 to $30,000. Which is fine when you're building a $1.5 million house, but when you're building a $40,000 house, maybe you don't want to spend the same amount for your septic system as you do your house. And they are mechanical in nature, so they do require maintenance, but that's a double-edged sword, and that could actually go in the pro side because you are monitoring and maintaining the system then. It does have a microprocessor, and it tells you if something is going wrong. For example, if a rodent chews into your drip tubing and you've got a leak in it now, it'll let you know that there's too much flow coming out of that one area. So our conclusions from this little look back at what we've done is that the drip irrigation appears to overcome the limitations of the expansive clays. Now, these are not hugely expansive clays like the bentonites we get out in, say, Wyoming, but they do have some expansion capacity to them, and this may be applicable to clays that are more expansive than this. They're applicable in new construction and in repair situations. Unfortunately, cost is an issue, and a large part of that cost is in the requirement for secondary treatment. So the old saying, if you can build a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. If you can come up with a cheaper secondary treatment system than a $7,000 aerobic unit, you could make some money on this. We're hoping, based on what we have seen from looking at these few systems, to go back and start looking at more and more of them and possibly apply them to other areas of serpentine-derived soils in southeastern Pennsylvania. Any questions? Yes, sir.
Can you describe the drip irrigation system for treating waste? How is it different from the traditional on-site septic system? Do you have the safety tank?
We use secondary treatment, so you're looking at either aerobic treatment or a septic tank, and then some kind of passive filter after that, like a sand filter. Or a peat filter, something like that, so that the effluent that we use to put out there is clear, odorless, colorless water. It is not the black water that you're associating with coming out of a septic tank. So it's a higher degree of treatment. As I mentioned, there's a mechanical filter. There are a couple of different configurations of them that takes out any large particulates down to about 100 microns. And then it goes out into the drip tubing like I showed in this slide, though I just showed a little fragment of it. This purple tubing down at the bottom. That's trenched in right below the grass, right in the A horizon, and distributes the water directly into the A horizon. So in a case where you have, for example, a grass lawn or a wooded site, the plants become a part of the system. It's introducing water right in the plant roots. And the biggest complaint we get from homeowners is that they have to mow their grass right up to about Christmas every year.
So you are not really concerned about fecal contamination from the creeks coming out?
No, because most of that is handled in the pre-treatment. No, because we're putting this into the A horizon. If there's anything, there's still live bacteria culture in that water, but we're introducing it into a very hostile environment. The A horizon has the greatest diversity of microorganisms, and nothing lives for very long when you put it in there. It gets eaten up pretty fast.
Thank you.